Your new book, New York Times bestseller, Red Shirts, about the sci-fi trope that I guess started with Star Trek of the noticing how on the away missions, suddenly the junior ranking ensign officer that no one had ever met before would go down with the away party and they would not return.
Not return.
Indeed. Somebody has to die, you know, to up the drama. And is it going to be the guys whose names are listed in the credits? Probably not. They have contracts, whereas Ensign Jones is there for the day. So he gets eaten by, you know, a space badger or a salt monster or whatever. And eventually, you know, the people who were fans who were watching this started noticing, going, statistically speaking, it's a really bad idea to go on an away mission with any of these folks. And so it's been a trope that's been in the nerd culture for, you know, literally decades now.
How did you come about your sort of larger premise here? And you can talk about that as much as you want to give away for the book.
Sure.
And how did that? How did you find your way into keeping your interest as far as being a writer who wants to write about characters doing something?
Sure. You have to play it straight with your characters. That it's an absurd situation, but these people live that absurd situation. I mean, part of it is, think about Ensign Smith or Ensign Jones, the poor guy who gets eaten by the space badger, right? Prior to being eaten by a space badger for dramatic purposes, this guy had been doing pretty well, right? He got through the academy, must have done pretty well in order to get onto, you know, the flagship of, you know, the space fleet. So all things considered, I mean, I'm pretty much sure that these guys were, like, elected, you know, most likely to succeed, you know, or they had some special talent up their sleeve or all these sorts of things. So you have to figure, if you're on that ship in the first place, you've done something right. And this was not, you know, going out by being consumed by a space badger was not how these people probably imagined themselves, you know, buying the farm, so to speak. And so that was always something that was in the back of my mind. So when I came to write this, part of this was exploring the idea that these people weren't fodder, you know, at least from their own point of view, that their lives had meaning and that their lives were serious and they didn't want to die. So how are they going to avoid these sorts of things? And when you actually take your character seriously, regardless of the absurdity of whatever your situation is, then you have the hook you need for actual drama, actual making the reader concerned, actual storytelling.
One thing that I'm sort of constantly fascinated with is how writers and books get classified into genre. Colson Whitehead writes a zombie novel, and he's still on a different shelf from
right.
all the other zombie novels.
Right.
So what makes a book a genre book versus a all that other book?
You know, a lot of it is just marketing. But, you know, frankly, these days there is a lot of literary fiction that uses science fiction or fantasy tropes. And, you know, the best example of this, Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Typical dystopic science fiction, and yet wins a Pulitzer Prize, is an Oprah pick, and all these sorts of things, because Cormac McCarthy is not himself identified as being a science fiction and fantasy writer. And this annoys a lot of science fiction and fantasy writers sometimes. They're like, how come I'm not on Oprah, or how come I'm not being considered for the Pulitzer, or any of those sorts of things. But I think that's really, there's two things to say. One, what this means is that genre in some ways has won the argument, and all the people who sneer at this sort of stuff have to confront that some of the best literature these days is being written with science fiction and fantasy tropes, whether or not it's being specifically addressed as being science fiction or fantasy. And secondly, you know what? You can still get onto the, you know, bestseller lists. You can still be considered a good writer. You can still do all these. You can still have an audience and still write these, you know, write in genre. You can, you know, I write science fiction. I managed to get onto the New York Times bestseller list this time. The book has been selling very well. There are lots of people who write crime thrillers or who write romances who are selling spectacularly well, reaching audiences, making differences in their lives in the sense of people are enjoying their work and getting something out of it. And the simple fact of the matter is, part of the reason that, you know, writers have all this angst is because they're worried about their legacy, right? You know, it's like if you win a Pulitzer, then maybe they'll, you know, think about you 100 years from now. Maybe they'll teach you in school. But you know what? A lot of that's not going to be up to them. I recently did something where I looked at the top 10 bestsellers of 1912, right? I went back and looked at them. And didn't read them, but just what the titles were. And I recognized none of the books, and I recognized only one or two of the authors. And these were the best-selling books of their time. Whereas, for example, Theodore Dreiser, who wrote Sister Carrie or something like that, is still taught and is still spoken about in terms of you know, being someone of importance, but he was not a bestseller of his time. What it says is history makes its own decisions about what's important and what's not, and frankly, all that will get sorted out long after you're dead. In the meantime, write something that you enjoy, that your readers will like, and that you'll have a good time with.
In your spotlight, you were talking about the how science fiction is written about the future, but because it's written in the present, it reflects the you know, the culture and the times in which it's written. And so a lot of science fiction ends up being about, because it is about the future, about our anxieties and fears about the future. So what are we afraid of these days? What do you think?
30 years ago, there was a lot of science fiction about, you know, global annihilation. You know, there was a lot of science fiction about overpopulation. There was concerns about biological issues. Part of the reasons that zombies are so big right now is that we have concerns about pandemics and diseases destroying the way that we live. So all of this gets reflected. Now, one of the great benefits that we have in science fiction and to a lesser extent fantasy, although certainly can do it there as well, is it allows us to practice what our response would be to these horrible situations. It's not exaggerating to say that that one of the reasons that we may have avoided, you know, global thermonuclear war is because we had so many science fiction books and movies and television shows that imagined that world just enough that people began to realize that there was no good victory condition once the missiles were flying, that it would just basically destroy the world as we know it. And obviously, I don't want to give too much weight to that. I think it is also, people did know that, you know, one nuclear bomb will ruin your whole day. But like I said, it was the practice of, we got to imagine it, we got to see that world, we got to see the implications of it. And it just gets into people's heads over and over again. So I think that even though it speaks to our fears, in some ways it lets us confront those fears and find ways to avoid making those fears become a reality. And so in that sort of sense, it's very beneficial, even though sometimes it can be really depressing.
So I guess all those zombie contingency plans that people are drawing up hypothetically also would really work in case there was just a big Spanish flu.
Well, and in fact, the CDC has, I think they have a pamphlet now where it really is, you know, zombie preparation guide. And the zombie preparation guide, coincidentally, is a really good emergency preparedness document. So if you are prepared for the zombies, you're also prepared for flooding or your power going out or whatever. There was that fellow in Miami who went a little bit crazy and, you know, attacked somebody and, you know, ate his face. And my daughter, who was 13, said, see, this is proof that the zombie apocalypse is coming. And she wasn't the only one. The CDC actually released a thing that said, this is not a zombie apocalypse. This is an isolated incident. And I showed that to my daughter, and my daughter, pitch perfect, responded, well, that's what the government would say, isn't it? So, but yes, in all honesty, you know, I think the CDC was smart to go, you know, if you're prepared for zombies, you'll also happen to be prepared for all these other things. And it's a way that people are, you know, a good way to get people thinking about what they should do to prepare for real life, fairly more realistic situations where they might need a go bag or they might need a week's worth of water and food. So, well done, CDC.
So you're working on a video game now. What is the writer's role in that kind of project?
Well, I can't give too many details yet, except to say that I'm working with a company called Industrial Toys. One of the founders of it is Alexander Seropian, who co-founded Bungie and who helped create Halo. And I can say it's going to be a first-person shooter. Part of the role that I do as the writer is you create a scenario for it that distinguishes it apart from other games in its genre. You give it a sort of twist and you give it a sort of idea that makes it interesting for people who've seen this sort of genre before. And it's not, of course, that's what you do, whatever you do as a writer. I mean, if you're writing a screenplay where it's a romantic comedy, you know, you want it to be more than just boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl again. You want to give it a new spin so that people who have seen, who know what a romantic comedy is, still get something of value. Same sort of thing here. We're creating a scenario that we think, at least, people haven't seen before, or if they've seen it, it hasn't been as successful as we hope that this particular scenario will be. So you create the world, you create a reason for these people to be doing these things, and you know, wind it up and then let people run with it. And it's really exciting because I play video games. You know, I've been playing them for, you know, since I was a kid. And, you know, one of my longtime goals was write a video game. And so when the fellow who helped make one of the most successful games in video game history says, "Want to help me write a new one?" You're like, "Yes."
Well, thanks so much, John.
Thank you.